In order to explore my theme tonight, I want to take you to one of John le Carré's novels, Absolute Friends, where the hero is reflecting on what I take to be the project of critical inquiry. And at one point he says, "I think I'll settle for what I don't want to know." And it seems to me that so much of critical inquiry, not simply inside the academy, but far beyond the academy, is about precisely that, sharing with one another things we don't want to know, but things that we must. I want to begin by trying to convey to you why somebody working in the field of geography should venture into the worlds of Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. And the easiest way I can do that to start with is through Elaine Scarry's brilliant book, The Body in Pain. She says this: "When one hears about another person's physical pain, the events happening within the interior of that person's body may seem to have the remote character of some deep subterranean fact, belonging to an invisible geography that, however portentous, has no reality because it has not yet manifested itself on the visible surface of the earth." Now, that supplies one reason why I've chosen to call this talk Vanishing Points. But as we go, I hope to supply another series of reasons for talking about vanishing points. These are two iconic images: Guantanamo on the left, Abu Ghraib on the right. And these images are, of course, arresting and shocking, but they've also become so familiar that in so many ways I think they stand in the way of fully understanding the geography that is at work behind them. I had thought, when I was preparing this talk, to begin with the testimony of those who've been released from Guantanamo, those who've been released from Abu Ghraib. But on reflection, I realized that if I did that, I would almost certainly elicit your horror at what I'm about to tell you. But I don't want you to be horrified that such things could be done to innocent people. Instead, I want you to be horrified that such things are done at all. And so I begin with Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib and the extraordinary attempts made to prise them apart, to keep apart those two images that I've just shown you. After all, the image on the left was taken by photographers employed by the Pentagon and released by the Pentagon for public display, a sign of a certain vanquishing, a certain triumph over the enemy. Those on the right were hardly authorized at all. The attempt to prise those two sites apart brings into view, I think, two exceptional geographies. Guantanamo Bay, in all sorts of ways, is a site where, as I plan to show you, legal protections were withdrawn for those detained there. It was, in formal philosophical terms, a space of exception, and I will explain and unpack that term in just a moment. It was also a profoundly ambiguous space, seemingly neither inside nor outside the United States, a space over which the United States exercises jurisdiction, but Cuba claims ultimate sovereignty. It's also a place of extraordinarily indefinite time, in which prisoners are subject to indefinite detention during what we were once assured was a perpetual war on terror. How different, then, from the official construction of Abu Ghraib, the Baghdad Central Correctional Facility, where here, rather than legal protections being withdrawn, legal sanctions were applied, at least to junior ranks. That's to say, the events constituted a crime scene. And that crime scene was fixed very precisely in space, Tier 1A of the hard site. And it had a very distinctive, precise chronology. These were isolated, we were assured, which took place in the night shift between September and December 2003. 3. What I want to show you is what lies behind those exceptional geographies and what connects them. Now, in order to do so, we need to take one very brief journey. For those of you who are resistant to travelling through political philosophy, this is a good moment to close your eyes and hum gently to yourselves. I will try to do this as gently as I can. I begin with this man, the man in the mirror, the Italian political philosopher Giorgio Agamben, whose starting point is a series of works produced by the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who, in the closing stages of his own academic journey, distinguished between two crucial modalities of power. One, an ancient mode of power, the right of the sovereign, sovereign power, exercised from a centre and descending down to the depths. But the other, a modern modality of power, which he called variously disciplinary power, biopolitics. This was exercised over the body and over the population at large, and it worked its way into the extremities and reached far beyond any single central state apparatus. And Agamben said, what is so interesting and so powerful about Foucault's contribution is that he identified these two modalities of power, two intersecting lines of flight, but seemed incapable of identifying where they converged. Now, as an aside, that's simply wrong. Foucault identifies very precisely where they converge, and it's exactly the same place that Agamben identifies. But for Agamben, he's interested in what he calls these two perspectival lines converging towards, here it is again, a vanishing point. A hidden point of intersection between the juridical institutional, read sovereign power, and the biopolitical models of power. This is precisely where Agamben says they converged. The camp, the concentration camp, and specifically Auschwitz. That is exactly the site that Foucault himself identified too, in the hideous experiments of the Third Reich. So for Agamben, the point of intersection between sovereign power and biopower is here, in the concentration camp, which he sees as the paradigmatic space of political modernity. It's here if we're going to understand what political modernity is about. It's here if we're going to open any single window to peer into its recesses. It's here that we should look. Because it's here we will see produced what Agamben calls bare life, life exposed to death. And the realm of bare life is produced, says Agamben, by the suspension of the juridical order's validity. In other words, the law is suspended. The protections of the law are withdrawn from particular groups, particular classes, typically, of course, racialized groups and racialized classes of people. And this is the space of exception, says Agamben, produced through martial law and the declaration of a state of emergency. And for Agamben, finally, modern politics is defined by this extraordinary double act in which bare life becomes a central object of political calculation, in which the state apparatus, and so many of its functionaries become obsessed with the pure biophysical reality of the human body. They become the objects of political calculation. And yet, in the same moment, in the same move, all subjectivity, all agency is removed from them with the protections of the law. They are not recognized as political subjects. And indeed, language, albeit not voice, is withdrawn from them. It becomes impossible for them to speak, to articulate their pain, except, of course, in cries of anguish. And for Agamben, this isn't simple metaphysics of power. This isn't a simple political philosophy at all. Rather, it's a diagnosis of the world in which we live. Faced with the unstoppable progression of what he sees as a global civil war, the state of exception tends increasingly to appear as the dominant paradigm of government in contemporary politics. Okay, you can open your eyes and stop the humming. We are back in the real world, and sadly, very much back in the real world. Many of you will know, I imagine, that following the hideous terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, President Bush declared two states of emergency, one on the 14th of September 2001 and a second on the 23rd of September, a further national emergency to deal with the unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States by grave acts of terrorism and threats of terrorism committed by foreign terrorists. Here, then, we seem to have the emergency, the arrogation of special emergency powers to the President, to the Commander-in-Chief, to the doctrine of the unitary executive. The national emergency has been renewed each year. But the cascade of national emergencies within your country does not begin with President Bush. He has, in fact, renewed seven previous national emergencies and declared eight others. Which is to say that despite the language used to proclaim them, emergencies in the United States are apparently not so unusual and extraordinary after all. Remember, I'll settle for knowing what I don't want to know. And so, many critics and commentators have, in a sense, danced under the shadow of Georges Agamben to suggest here suspension of the law. Here's Philippe Sands, with the election of George W. Bush, a US administration office. I think this is the CIA, but I just assume their microphones are more powerful. Spoken in its determination to challenge global rules. Soon it turned into a full-scale assault on law. And indeed, in some ways, the president has given ample ammunition to such critics. International law, he said, I better call my lawyer. I don't know what you're talking about by international law. What I want to persuade you of this evening is that he knows very well what international law is, and that he's repeatedly called his lawyers. Because after all, neoconservatives display a Janus face to the law. Theirs is, on the one hand, a project to disparage the law, to complain about activist judges, to insist upon deregulation, and to uphold the doctrine of the unitary executive. While at the same time, it's a project to write new laws that restrict democratic politics, that roll back human rights, verify the free market. So what I want to do is to outline four complications to both Agamben's view about the state of exception, the suspension of the law, the withdrawal of legal protections, and about those who believe that what the present administration is about rolling back, disregarding the law. And I hope you'll keep these four markers in mind as we travel on. The first is that the shadows that fall over the space of exception reach back beyond the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, beyond the chimneys of Auschwitz, right back into a colonial past which is being reactivated in our colonial present. The origins of the concentration camp, after all, lie in colonial wars in South Africa and on the island of Cuba. Secondly, I want to worry away at international law because so much of what Agamben has to say is about a state suspending its own laws during a time of emergency. He pays great attention to the way in which this takes place during times of war, but he's remarkably silent about international law, which raises a whole series of quite other questions. Thirdly, Agamben is so invested in those wretched human beings who've had the protections of the law removed from them, a figure sometimes known by the Roman term of homo sacer, sacred man, accursed man. But what he fails to register is the much larger apparatus through which that takes place. His gaze is so concentrated on that spectral figure that the larger landscape is plunged into darkness. And lastly, so it seems to me, Agamben writes as though this is ineluctable, inevitable. There's nothing we can do about it. And on the contrary, I want to show you that this is a process which has been resisted at every turn. And it's important for us to know that it's been resisted inside the present administration as well as outside. It's been resisted by lawyers within the armed forces of the United States. It's been resisted by organizations inside the United States, and it's been resisted by the people of the United States, as well, of course, by a host of other people far beyond these shores. And in so very many ways, I hope that this talk is a small step in advancing that project. So my first complication is to remind us that this has a much longer and essentially a colonial history. But every bit as important, we need to understand that even though colonial power often worked through the most extraordinary savage displays of violence, it was also very careful to do so much of this through the law. Colonial dispossession proceeded through legal formulae. So that violence is not somehow outside the law, but it's so very often rolled inside the law. And you can see that even more insistently with the impress of colonial power. The people of Afghanistan, the people of Iraq, and the people of occupied Palestine know that only too well. Secondly, remember, international law. Here we come to another set of vanishing points. Stay with me. International law is rather strange, you see, because so my lawyer friends tell me, that's not an oxymoron, so my lawyer friends tell me, international law is not really proper law. And the reason it's not really proper law is that it's not underwritten by a single sovereign. It's rather cobbled together by customary practice, by agreement, by convention. So much so that in the 19th century, John Austin claimed that international law is located effectively at the vanishing point of law. Well, Hirsch Lauterpacht, soon after the Second World War, said much the same about the law of war. It's even more conspicuously at the vanishing point of international law. Stay with me. Much more recently, one of Donald Rumsfeld's many special legal advisors, there's probably nobody who needs as many as Donald Rumsfeld, at least so we can hope, said that the war on terror is at the vanishing point of international law, of the law of war. Now stay with me. Three telescoping moments. International law at the vanishing point of law. The law of war at the vanishing point of international law. The war on terror at the vanishing point of the law of war. Now, if you follow those lines of flight, the kind of perspective that they open up, where do you end up? You end up at Guantanamo and at Abu Ghraib. But if we go to these vanishing points, of course, they're not invisible. We're able to glimpse something, but only something. These are spaces of constructed visibility, spaces of constricted visibility. Now, there's much to say about the different reception of the photographs of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. But what I'm interested in is the way in which these photographs of Abu Ghraib became aestheticized. This is taken from a photography exhibition which traveled through Chicago and New York. And of course, then there were a whole series of iconographic representations, guerrilla posters like iPod Iraq on the left, the extraordinary canvases of Botero on the right. Now, this constant play with the gaze, with the visible, with witnessing, has its own cost. The philosopher Jay Bernstein puts it like this. At no point, he says, does Agamben's account veer off from the space of impossible sight, those vanishing points, to the wider terrain, from the victim to the executioner, to the nature of the camps, to the ethical dispositions of those set upon reducing the human to the inhuman. Just the inhuman itself fills Agamben's gaze, and hence ours. Such is the pure desire to bear witness, to see, to confront those images. And what I want to do is to bring into view that larger apparatus of violence, and in so doing, to mark those moments where resistance can be felt. So we begin our journey here at Guantanamo Bay with those markers in mind: colonial power and the colonial legacy, the complex geography of international law, the politics of witnessing, and the possibility of resistance. How then does the United States come to occupy Guantanamo Bay? Here we need to understand three imperial powers: Spain, the United States, and the Soviet Union, because all of them can be brought to bear on Guantanamo Bay. Very simply, the Spanish-American War of 1898 attracted widespread support within the United States, not least because of the vicious policy pursued by the Spanish military regime occupying the island. They put in place a policy of reconcentración, of concentrating the rural population into concentration camps. And it was images like these which inflamed public opinion in the United States at the plight of those victims. And it was that which then gave the government the excuse it was seeking for to intervene in the Revolutionary War of Independence, hence the Spanish-American War. The consequence of that, of course, was that ultimately the United States won the right to run its own concentration camp on the island of Cuba. And it did so through the Platt Amendment, and specifically this lease. These are the terms of the lease in which the United States recognizes the ultimate sovereignty of Cuba, but nonetheless insists that it shall exercise complete jurisdiction and control over that base. Then, during the missile crisis of 1962, Robert McNamara proposed handing back Guantanamo to the Cubans as a quid pro quo for the withdrawal of Soviet missiles from the island. Kennedy refused. And in fact, over the years, Guantanamo became one of the symbolic front lines in the Cold War as those two vast systems faced off. Now, if we look then at those three moments, those three powers, Spain, the United States, and the Soviet Union, it's not difficult to see the shadows of a colonial past constantly being reactivated. It's not difficult to see either the way in which the law was inserted into that narrative. And indeed, the island was used for camps in the 1990s, refugees from Haiti, and then again, asylum seekers from Cuba. And that provides the basis for the use of Guantanamo during the War on Terror. You can see, I think, why Amy Kaplan sees at work here a logic grounded in imperialism, in which coercive state power is routinely mobilized beyond the sovereignty of national territory, outside the continental United States, but also, she says, outside the rule of law. Judith Butler says much the same, talking about the War on Terror, specifically in Guantanamo Bay, as a law that is no law, court that is no court, a process that is no process. But I'm persuaded by others, by Fleur Johns, who says that the plight of the Guantanamo detainees is less an outcome of law's suspension than of elaborate regulatory efforts. In other words, the law is enrolled and enlisted in this process at every single turn. Or again, Christiane Wilke. Guantanamo was not placed outside the law, she says. Prisoners were confined in a place of rightlessness that was not lawless. And this is where we begin to return to Agamben, because I want to show you that prisoners there were treated as legal objects, not legal subjects, and that the War on Terror was indeed going to be prosecuted through their very bodies. And this works through the mobilization of two contradictory geographies. Here you can see how cartoonists around the world respond to this. All reading material is being confiscated for security reasons. It's the Geneva Conventions that are being removed. Here we are. They're not terrorists. They're terrorists, not humans. That's what I mean by the withdrawal of rights. That's what I mean by reducing people to objects. But as I say, this works through two contradictory legal geographies. The first speaks to spaces of detention. I'm not a lawyer, so bear with me if you are. Congress granted all federal courts the right to issue a writ of habeas corpus to release from custody prisoners held by state or federal agencies in violation. And so the first question was where prisoners during the War on Terror could be detained. The first sites to be considered were these in the Pacific, the islands of Midway, Wake, and Trinian, until it was discovered that they were all within the jurisdiction of the Federal Court of Hawaii. The advantage of Guantanamo Bay, so it was believed, according to this memorandum from the Department of Justice, an Orwellian term if ever there was one, a federal district court could not properly exercise habeas jurisdiction over an alien detained at Guantanamo because Guantanamo is neither part of the United States nor a possession or territory. And indeed, one White House counsel argued that Guantanamo's indeterminate location would eliminate an important legal ambiguity by removing the prospect of habeas corpus proceedings. So that the reactivation of those camps produced exactly the space that the president himself had envisaged. When he was determined to try suspects for violation of the laws of war and other applicable laws, so acknowledging the supremacy of the law, while at the same time, in that same order, insisting that the principles of law and the rules of evidence generally recognized in the trial of criminal cases in the United States could not be applied. Why? Because this was outside the United States. Here is Guantanamo Bay. The original camp was Camp X-ray at the top there, replaced subsequently by Camp Delta at the very bottom. These are the images that I imagine most of you have seen, and here surely is bare life, produced and paraded. Who are these people? Surely they deserve this. Rumsfeld had no doubt. They are the worst of the worst. Well, not according to the CIA. One CIA analyst concluded very early on that many of the prisoners were minor players or wholly innocent, turned in by warlords, local militia and villages to settle scores or to receive bounties. The image on the right is a leaflet dropped over Afghanistan promising people enough money to support themselves, their family, their village and their tribe forever. An analysis by Seton Hall Law School showed that 95% of detainees who Rumsfeld claimed were captured on the battlefield were in fact captured by Pakistan or the Northern Alliance, not by US forces at all, and that on the United States government's own admission, 55% of them hadn't committed any hostile acts against the United States or its enemies. They went into the evidence paraded in the depositions for their continuing detention. In many cases, the single probative evidence was possession of a Casio watch which could be used for a bomb timer. Now, of course, as you leave this room, you will all be subject to a strip search, so this will be a very convenient moment for those of you who have Casio watches to remove them. Now, of course, all of this has been resisted in multiple and complex ways. The US Court of Appeals insisted that the United States was the temporary sovereign over Guantanamo Bay so that it did have jurisdiction. The Supreme Court in 2004 said that it wasn't even necessary to establish sovereignty. It could hear habeas corpus petitions. The US exercised complete jurisdiction over the base. Of course, there was opposition. But the response from the National Security Council was to suspend transfers from Afghanistan to Guantanamo immediately. All eyes were on Guantanamo. Very few eyes are on Bagram, where more and more and more of the detritus from the War on Terror is being warehoused in conditions that we don't know about and in sites that the International Committee of the Red Cross are forbidden from visiting. But it's not just about detention. It is, as we all surely know, also about interrogation. President Bush did not suspend the law. He did not suspend the Geneva Conventions. He said he had the authority to do so, but he simply said they did not apply. Therefore, those seized on the field of battle were not prisoners of war, but unlawful combatants. And this man, descending from the depths, Alberto Gonzalez, insisted that all of this was brought about because the War on Terror inaugurated a new paradigm that required interrogators to quickly obtain information. Now think about it. everything I've been talking about thus far is about indefinite detention, about the clock stopping. But what you've now got is a second imperative in which everything speeds up. There's a demand for information from these people. And so what you find at the highest reaches of the administration is an obsession with torture. This is their word, not mine. And they receive detailed legal advice about the bearing of the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment or punishment. Now, what's interesting about this international statute is that it becomes part of US law through the US Code, Title 18, in which torture committed outside the United States becomes an offense. Ah, problem. We are holding these people in Guantanamo Bay so that they are outside the reach of US courts, and we can do that because it's outside the United States. How then can we subject them to what President Bush calls alternative methods of interrogation? Well, the answer is very simple. For the purposes of this statute, Guantanamo Bay is deemed inside the United States. That's what I mean by a contradictory legal geography. The United States is defined as all areas under the jurisdiction of the United States. So now Guantanamo Bay is moved conveniently inside the United States. So, as the memo puts it, the torture statute does not apply to the conduct of US personnel at Guantanamo Bay. The rest of the story, I'm sure you know. 24 techniques were eventually approved by the Pentagon, signed by Donald Rumsfeld. What's interesting about these techniques, though, is that if you read them, I suspect you might not be horrified by them. They seem banal, bland. But what's missing from that list is two things. The first is any sense of limit. Here is the General Counsel of the US Navy. What did deprivation of light and auditory stimuli mean? Could a detainee be locked in a completely dark cell? And for how long? A month? Longer? What precisely did the authority to exploit phobias mean? Could a detainee be held in a coffin? Could phobias be applied until madness set in? But it's just a list. There are no limits. There's also no discussion of the effects. But thanks to Alfred McCoy, we know that since the Second World War, a consistent interrogation protocol has been developed, which relies on sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain. The method relies, he says, on simple and banal procedures: isolation, standing, heat and cold, light and dark, noise and silence. Doesn't sound so bad, does it? Sounds like a rave or a disco, but together, these produce a systematic assault on all the senses. It turns out that subjects could only endure 2 or 3 days of being goggled, gloved and muffled in a lighted cubicle. While forced standing for 18 to 24 hours, that's all you're doing, forcing people to stand. Produces excruciating pain as ankles swelled, blisters erupted, heart rate soared and kidneys shut down. That's what we're talking about. It's not just waterboarding. But in any case, there were a series of exemptions, because even once that list had been set up, Rumsfeld insisted that interrogators had to be provided with reasonable latitude to vary techniques for reasons that included the degree of resistance and the urgency of obtaining information. And of course, the CIA was exempt anyway. It was able to use a whole series of further techniques, including waterboarding. As the Washington Post put it, if an American pilot is captured in the Middle East, then beaten, held naked in a cold cell, and subject to simulated drowning, would the director of the CIA still say that he has not been tortured? Many of you may point me to the McCain Amendment and the Detainee Treatment Act, but you will surely know that once that passed, the president added a signing statement saying that he would interpret it consistent with constitutional limitations on the judicial power, and he reserved the right to waive its provision in special circumstances. More than this, the Detainee Treatment Act reaffirmed that the Supreme Court had no jurisdiction over those. Then we have the long summer of 2006, in which it appeared that sanity was setting in. The Supreme Court ruled military tribunals illegal, insisted that those detainees were protected under Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. The Pentagon issued a revised Army Field Manual, setting out new rules for the conduct of interrogation consistent with their obligations under the Geneva Convention. John Yoo complained that the court decision suppressed creative thinking. The Geneva Conventions are not a source of judicially enforceable individual rights. But then, as we know, the Military Commissions Act was passed, signed by President Bush, protecting America on the 18th of October 2006. This simply rewrites the law. Courts can no longer entertain habeas corpus petitions from unlawful enemy combatants. Prisoners released without charge can seek no legal redress. Military tribunals are now authorized, including the submission of hearsay and evidence from coercive interrogation where the court stated that it's reliable. Past violations of the Geneva Conventions are not subject to legal sanction, and on and on. One law professor says that, John Yoo, that this is a stinging rebuke to the Supreme Court, which creatively misread the law. Congress and the president didn't take that lying down. They told the courts to get out of the war on terror. But another law professor says that what this does is enshrines a state practice for people worthy of only special process, and so constitutes a group of human beings separated from the rest of humankind. That is bare life. Here's Paul Gilroy. These fine ethnic distinctions revive a colonial economy in which infrahumanity diminishes human rights and can defer recognition. The native, the enemy, the prisoner, and all the other shadowy third things lodged between animal and human can only be held accountable under special emergency rules and fierce martial laws. Their lowly status underscores the fact that they cannot be reciprocally endowed with the same vital humanity enjoyed by their well-heeled captors, conquerors, judges, executioners, and other racial betters. That's what I mean by a colonial past reactivated in a colonial present. Abu Ghraib reveals another contradictory geography. What we were told in the wake of those extraordinary images from Abu Ghraib was that tortured Abu Ghraib was exceptional. The prison, we were told, was overcrowded, under-resourced, poorly defended, racked by riots, constantly attacked by mortars. So that Abu Ghraib was a part of chaos outside the normal order. It was described as the forgotten outpost, the prison on the brink, a hellish place. But outside Abu Ghraib, the rest of Iraq was descending into chaos too. Hear from the Coalition Provisional Authority's website. For security reasons, there are no security reports. In response to that chaos, the level of military violence was ratcheted up. And to make those counterinsurgency operations more effective, Abu Ghraib was enrolled directly, centrally, into the business of gathering intelligence to underwrite the counterinsurgency operation. That's why it became a joint interrogation and detention center. So that Abu Ghraib wasn't exceptional at all. It was folded directly, intimately, centrally into counterinsurgency operations. And it seems to me that any attempt to treat what happened at Abu Ghraib as exceptional glosses over the inherent violence of military occupation. But of course, Abu Ghraib doesn't stand alone. The Department of Defense sent an investigation team to Iraq in May 2003. It discovered that most prisons in Iraq were so badly damaged they couldn't be used. And you must understand, this focus, this emphasis on imprisonment, ought to reveal just how central detention and interrogation is to the war on terror. Abu Ghraib, though, they considered the closest to an American prison, attached priority to its reconstruction. So having the prison, what then is the strategy for interrogation and intelligence? Well, it had three elements: the designation of prisoners, the so-called enhancement of interrogation methods, and the outsourcing of detention and interrogation. Firstly, the designation of prisoners. You will remember, I'm sure, that President Bush decided that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to the war in Afghanistan, so that those detained there, those captured there, were not prisoners of war. He determined that the Geneva Conventions would apply to the conflict in Iraq, but nonetheless, the military used exactly the same designation for those that they captured. Persons under control, PUC. Then, many of them were designated, in fact the vast majority of them, security detainees. This is a provision allowed for in the Geneva Conventions. It's a category which is to be used in exceptional circumstances for individual cases for reasons of urgent military necessity. This withdraws a whole series of rights from those prisoners, which they would normally enjoy under the Geneva Conventions. By April 2004, 95% of those detained by the US military had been classified as security detainees. And then, of course, eventually, Lieutenant General Sanchez designates a large number of them as unlawful combatants, exactly in the terms of the president's military order. So these designations are not innocent. They carry with them the suspension of a whole series of rights. What about interrogation? Remember, that's what's needed to prosecute counterinsurgency within an increasingly restive, resistant Iraq. Well, the Department of Defense sends a team from Guantanamo Bay to Iraq, headed by this man, Major General Jeffrey Miller, who describes Guantanamo as a central laboratory for the war on terror, where new approaches and operational art could be transferred to Iraq. This is operational art, ladies and gentlemen. This is a US Army briefing slide showing the interrogation process, in which you will see the smiley ghost is the prisoner. You will notice too that the smile rapidly disappears during the interrogation process. But that's misleading, because you see, Major General Miller is on record as saying that prisoners are not subject to any physical contact, stress positions, or sleep deprivation during interrogations. But part of his report was to recommend the immediate transition from tactical to strategic interrogation, in which the rapid exploitation of prisoners for actionable intelligence would be given a priority. It is essential, he concluded, that the guard force be actively engaged in setting the conditions for the successful exploitation of the internees. Juxtapose the top and the bottom. Prisoners are not subject to any physical contact, stress positions, or sleep deprivation during interrogations. They don't have to be, because the guard force is actively engaged in setting the conditions for the successful exploitation of the internees. Much of this report, by the way, is written in the language of the Harvard Business School, and you have to decode it to realize what it is they're recommending. Eventually, of course, Major General Miller is transferred from Guantanamo to assume control of US Department of Defense prison operations in Iraq. And what we find is that the operating procedure, which comes into view at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, is widespread throughout Iraq, to the point where it constitutes, according to Human Rights Watch, a standard operating procedure. Soldiers said they felt welcome to come to the PUC tent on their off hours to fuck a PUC or smoke a PUC, which means beating a detainee or forcing physical exertion upon them and to the point of unconsciousness. Elsewhere too, this from the New York Times, and on and on. Lastly, outsourcing. Well, private contractors, the Coalition of the Billing, were employed as both interpreters and interrogators. The important point here is that contractors are not subject to the military justice system, and the Coalition Provisional Authority explicitly excluded them from the provisions of Iraqi law. This is one of the major contracting companies, CACI, which also has a contract for supplying training videos on ethics to the US government. In March 2004, the White House asked whether prisoners could be forcibly transferred from Iraq to sites where they could be held indefinitely and subject to alternative methods of interrogation. This is illegal under international law, but the Department of Justice invoked an Iraqi law which said that anyone who had entered the country illegally, this isn't those wearing US Army uniforms, anyone who's entered the country illegally could be both imprisoned and deported. And that's the law that was invoked to make their transfer legal. And so this takes us into the dark world of extraordinary renditions, the world experienced by, for example, my compatriot Mayor Arar. The Minimalist report says that 100 to 150 people have been forcibly transferred to jails in Egypt, Jordan, Libya, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Uzbekistan, all destinations cited by the State Department for their violation of human rights. And through the efforts of Human Rights Watch, determined journalists Thompson, Trevor Paglen, and Stephen Gray, we know a great deal about the routes charted by these private planes as they crisscross the world between Guantanamo, Iraq, and a host of other so-called black sites. Civilian aircraft are used because the law is permissive. The Chicago Convention on International Civil Aviation makes it unnecessary for non-scheduled, non-commercial civilian aircraft to seek permission to pass through foreign airspace or land at civilian airports. If they were to use regular military aircraft, all kinds of permissions would be required. But the assumption was that in using civilian aircraft, no trace would be left. This is the moment to record our debt to plane spotters around the world. A phrase I never thought would drop from my lips. And then private shell companies are used to operate these companies because, as one CIA agent put it, you can set them up quickly and dismantle them when they're exposed. Then a whole network of CIA black sites in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan, in Qatar, and Yemen, Diego Garcia, Thailand, Guantanamo itself, in the Czech Republic, Poland, and Romania. This is the salt pit in Afghanistan. And so we edge still closer to what happens in Abu Ghraib. Many of my colleagues urge me to think about what happens instead within the United States' own prison system. You know, over 2 million citizens are jailed. Around 50% of them is African American. And in so very many ways, domestic prisons are one of the sites in which Islam confronts detention. But I don't think it's enough to simply transfer the prison nation overseas, because the war on terror gives those prisons that I've been describing to you a very special inflection. After all, President Bush has assiduously cultivated a vast poison orchard tended by an army of undergardeners. As soon as you say that in the war on terror we are casting out the devil, we are setting our face against evil, we are fighting off the inhuman. Well, Carl Schmitt says it. As soon as you claim to be fighting in the name of inhumanity, you immediately cast your opponent as the inhuman. And as soon as you've imaginatively performed that reduction, it becomes much easier to treat people in these ways. But there's more. Back to Elaine Scarry. She says, think about what happens in the torture chamber. It's only the prisoner's steadily shrinking ground, she says, that wins for the torturer his swelling sense of territory. There's a kind of intimacy to this geography. And what that might mean, I suspect, is that outside Abu Ghraib and all those other detention centers, remember, military control over Iraq is under constant assault. It's being beaten back again and again and again through a bloody and violent insurgency. But inside those cells, inside the razor wire, for some brief moments, it's possible to recover that sense of mastery which is slipping away outside, to push back and create that expanding sense of territory inside the cell. Alan Feldman, professor at New York, puts this better than me. The perpetuators acquire, he says, if only in an allegorical idiom, their former sense of mastery and command in a situation that's rapidly lurching beyond their grasp. The hooded and faceless bodies that are being manipulated and posed are merely emblems of a collective, recalcitrant Iraqi body politic that has to be dissected as the treacherous social surface of an occupied Iraq. But there's even more than this, because what we saw on display in Iraq was was not improvised. This was not a theatre of cruelty devised by hometown, homeland soldiers. It was astonishingly knowing. I've already talked about the policy that underwrites this, that makes so much of this possible. But if you look at those images, you should surely notice two things. Firstly, an extraordinary capacity to degrade and exploit Arab and Islamic cultures. And in order to do that, you must know what you are doing. And more than that, the positions. Many of you, I'm sure, will have seen images of prisoners with their hands chained behind them, suspended from the bars of a cell. It's known to security services throughout the world as the Palestinian hanging. That position is known as the Vietnam. This is not casual improvisational theatre. This is known and planned and systematic. So let me end with these thoughts. The question is Amy Kaplan's. She says, where is Guantanamo? Well, to be sure, it is on the island of Cuba. An extraordinary number of people have been released, but an extraordinary number of people remain. And although the president is on record as saying he would like to close it down, new facilities are being built, Camp 5, Camp 6, multi-million dollar state-of-the-art facilities. Now, of course, there's nothing unusual about this. It's a common dodge. As I read the papers this week, I discover that the White House and the Pentagon are saying, well, we can't stay in Iraq forever. Eventually, the Iraqis have got to step up and take responsibility. This is the same administration who is at the same time completing the largest US embassy in the world in Baghdad. We can't stay there forever in exactly the same way. We want to close this down, which is why we're building two new jails. Where is Guantanamo? Well, it's not only in Cuba, of course. The wheel has turned full circle. It's also here, back in Afghanistan. Remember all of those people no longer being transferred to Guantanamo, being held instead at places like the old Soviet airbase at Bagram, in a vast former maintenance shed, with even less facilities than are provided for the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And in a sense, Guantanamo is replicated in sites all over the world, not just by the United States, but by other states too. Belmarsh Prison in Britain, Prison 391 in Israel, and on and on and on. But of course, it's also here. It's inside the United States. I hope then that I've convinced you of two things. That firstly, critical inquiry is about sharing with one another things we don't want to know. And secondly, although Austin Surratt writes that the violence of law is often untraceably dispersed, through the efforts of all of the people whose work I've enrolled in this talk tonight, extraordinarily courageous people, as I say, people inside the present administration as well as outside, lawyers working for prisoners through the Department of Defense, organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, a host of brave, courageous investigative journalists. Through all of them, it is possible to trace the violence of the law and to understand what's done in our name. That's why I think geography matters. And ultimately, of course, this is why it matters. If we don't speak out, who knows which of us could find ourselves standing on boxes, hoods over our faces, wires attached to our trembling fingers, and waiting for somebody to pull the switch. That's not the United States I know. It's not the United States I admire. Thank you.